Tonight, Marvel casts the Fantastic, DC changes dates, Discovery sets its date, plus legal expert Andrew Torres and I break down the Gina Carano lawsuit. All that and more on this edition of Multiverse Tonight!
Comic books, sci-fi, fantasy, and more. If you're looking for a roundup of geeky news, you're in the right place. This is Multiverse Tonight. And here's your host, Thomas Townley.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 209 of Multiverse Tonight. I'm, of course, your affable host, Thomas Townley. And, well, it seems to be spring bordering on summer outside right now. It's currently in the 70s outside. So, you know, I don't have a lot to start out here. You know, nothing really big has been happening. You know, I'm still staying home, not going to Comic-Con this year. So, but I do have a treat for you on today's episode. Lawyer P. Andrew Torres of a specific podcast, which I'm not going to mention here because there's been an issue. But well-known legal analyst Andrew Torres will be on the show to discuss the Gina Carano lawsuit that was filed back at the beginning of February. And that'll be a relatively lengthy discussion. So let's just get on with the Marvel news. And we begin Marvel news with Marvel Studios finally confirming the cast of its upcoming Fantastic Four movie. A piece of Valentine's Day themed art released on Marvel Studios social media accounts confirmed that Pedro Pascal will play Reed Richards, aka Mr. Fantastic. Vanessa Kirby will play Susan Storm, aka Invisible Woman. Joseph Quinn will play Johnny Storm, aka the Human Torch, and Ebon Mesbakrak will be playing Ben Grimm, aka The Thing. The artwork was done by Wesley Burt, and the new logo was in a style reminiscent of the 1960s, the decade in which the Fantastic Four first appeared on comic book stands. And this led to some speculation that suggests that the movie might be a period piece set back in the 60s, or at least include some scenes from that time, though no plot details for the film have yet to be officially released. Matt Shackman is directing the movie, which is still slated for theaters on July 25th, 2025. Whether it be Skrulls, symbiotes, or vampires, when Earth is being invaded, there's one hero you can count on to be on the front lines, Wolverine. When the undead rise, the eternal night falls, and Jed McKay and Pepe Lazara's blood hunt, Wolverine will confront them claws first. The four-issue series will mark the Marvel Comics debut of writer Tom Waltz, known for his acclaimed run on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin, and will be joined by artist Juan Jose Rape, who has been already delivered a Berserker's Rage of Wolverine action in the character's current solo series. In addition to spinning directly off Blood Hunt, Wolverine's blood-soaked battles will also conclude Logan's private war against the Vampire Nation, a storyline that's been heating up over the past few pages of the epic Wolverine run. Now, Logan will fight back against the darkness, and we'll be fighting the vampires as the sky darkens across the globe and vampires reign. What's the hidden plot putting Logan directly in the crosshairs? Hint, it's nothing you've seen in Blood Hunt yet, but there is a plot and blood thickening as a secret vampire sect is exacting revenge on Logan and the world, which will take him to the brink. Now this will guest star some surprise characters from Wolverine's past and the return of Louise of the Night Guard. So, Wolverine Blood Hunt, coming to a store near you. Also coming is Morbius, the Living Vampire. When Vampire Legions unite and usher in a new Eternal Night, Morbius's unique self-inflicted bloodlust may hold the key to reversing it or strengthening it. Spider-Man will be tasked to find his iconic vampiric villain in Amazing Spider-Man Blood Hunt, a new tie-in spanning out of Judd McKay and Pepe Lazare's Blood Hunt crossover event. Written by Justina Ireland and drawn by Marcella Ferreira, Spider-Man Blood Hunt will see Spidey team up with Misty Knight and the Lizard to rescue Morbius, who's already fallen into the vampire overlord's clutches. Now, Ireland did share that she thinks getting to write Morbius has been a lot of fun, and that he's always been a delightful foil to Spider-Man. So get ready to see that on your store shelves as well. Also, what would be without Wolverine and Deadpool getting back together? Not only are they coming up in the Deadpool and Wolverine movie, but they'll also be teaming back up in a new comic book together. Marvel Comics, announced that a new series will follow Deadpool and Wolverine on some wild adventures. You can read a description of Deadpool and Wolverine World War III, quote, the most intensely mismatched team-up in comics and pop culture, the best there is and the merc with the mouth, undergo a radical change in an all-new three-part globe-spanning saga for the ages in Deadpool and Wolverine World War III, number one, which will be on stands this May. Acclaimed writer Joe Kelly marks his return to Deadpool in a new series alongside legendary artist Adam Kubert. The mysterious Delta believes in change. Change is good. But as he sets his sights on Deadpool and Wolverine is caught up in the plot, is the third time really the charm or the curse? Get ready for World War III to erupt in the scene with the wildest duo in comics from Legends Joe Kelly and Adam Kubert. Unquote. Now let's go on to the DC Comics news. And DC Comics news begins with DC Comics moving its release schedule back to Wednesdays. This past week, as part of a presentation at the Comics Pro Comic Industry Conference, DC announced plans to move back to Wednesday, starting Wednesday, July 3rd, and this will only affect single issues. New collected editions and graphic novels will still be released on Tuesdays. Now, DC initially pivoted to Tuesday from the industry standard of Wednesday back in 2020 amid supply chain disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. That initial decision also came amid the company's distribution move from Diamond Comics to Penguin Random House, with other publishers like Marvel and IDW soon following suit. Also announced at Comics Pro this summer will bring the launch of Absolute Power, a new event miniseries shepherded by Mark Waid and artist Dan Mora, who partnered together on DC series such as Batman, Superman, World's Finest, and Shazam. Absolute Power shows how Amanda Waller will use the strategic and military might of Failsafe and the otherworldly technology of the Brainiac Queen to steal all metahuman abilities from every superhero and supervillain around the globe. A threat so dire that will take the combined efforts of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and the superheroes of the DC Universe to defeat it. Absolute Power will kick off with DC's Free Comic Book Day issue, which will be available at comic book stores on Saturday, March 4th, 2024. Absolute Power Free Comic Book Day Special Edition will be a 32-page comic featuring an original 12-page story by Waid with art by Mikkel Janin, as well as a preview of Absolute Power's first issue. It will be followed by Absolute Power Ground Zero, the official prelude, which will debut in June, and the shocking conclusion of the Superman story House of Brainiac with Amanda Waller's machinations. Now this next one, really interesting. Hell seems to have frozen over. Marvel and DC are having a brief moment of cooperation and are releasing two collections of their co-produced comic books. First, DC vs. Marvel Omnibus, and second, DC Marvel The Amalgam Age Omnibus, which will both be out on August 6, 2024. First off, DC Marvel Comics Omnibus will collect Batman, Captain America number 1, Batman Daredevil number 1, Batman Punisher Lake of Fire, Batman Spider-Man, Daredevil Batman, DC Special Series number 27, Darkseid vs. Galactus, The Hunger number 1, Green Lantern, Silver Surfer, Unholy Alliances, Incredible Hulk vs. Spider-Man, and Marvel and DC Present, featuring the Uncanny X-Men and New Teen Titans. Marvel Treasury Edition number 28, Punisher Batman Deadly Knights number 1, Silver Surfer Superman, Spider-Man Batman, Superman vs. the Amazing Spider-Man, and Superman Fantastic Four. The DC Marvel The Amalgam Age Omnibus will collect DC vs. Marvel number 1 through 4, DC Marvel All Access 1 through 4, Ultimate Access 1 through 4, Bat-Thing number 1, Bruce Wayne Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 1, Bullets and Bracelets number 1, Challenges of the Fantastic number 1, Doctor Strange Fate number 1, Iron Lantern number 1, Legends of the Dark Knight, well, these are all number 1s, of course, Lobo the Duck, Speed Demon, Spider-Boy, Super Soldier, Thorian of the New Asgods, X-Patrol, and more, plus a treasure trove of behind-the-scenes material. DC Marvel, the Amalgam Age Omnibus, will feature stories first told back in 1996 when the two universes fused together to create the Amalgam Universe. Oh, what a time that was, folks. The result was a series of unforgettable one-shot comic books starring the likes of Dark Claw, which was Batman Wolverine, Super Soldier, which was Superman Captain America, Iron Lantern, which was Iron Man and Green Lantern, and many more. And these comics came from creators such as Peter David, Dan Jurgens, Mark Waid, Dave Gibbons, Ron Mars, Jose Lopez, Garcia Lopez, Gary Frank, Bill Sienkiewicz, Claudio Castellani, and much more. And was one of the most epic times in comic books. I went to the comic book store. You know, I was foaming at the mouth for those. That was a fun time to be a comic book fan. Again, these will both come out on August 6th, and the two volumes will have a direct market exclusive cover available only to comic book shops while supplies last. And now, let's go to the Star Trek news. Star Trek news begins with Paramount Plus announcing the return of Star Trek Discovery for its fifth and final season. The show will premiere on Thursday, April 4th on Paramount Plus in the US and UK, Switzerland, South Korea, Latin America, Germany, France, Italy, Australia, and Austria. Star Trek Discovery Season 5 will also premiere on April 4th on Paramount Plus in Canada. The Star Trek Discovery Season 5 will see the first two episodes of the series' final 10-episode season released at launch, with new episodes following every Thursday. Here's the official synopsis from Paramount+. The fifth and final season will find Captain Burnham and the crew of the USS Discovery uncovering a mystery that will send them on an epic adventure across the galaxy to find an ancient power whose very existence has been deliberately hidden for centuries. But there are others on the hunt as well. Dangerous foes who are desperate to claim the prize for themselves and will stop at nothing to get it. Unquote. Now, the episode titles have been revealed, so, you know, take what you will from the titles. They are Red Directive, Under the Twin Moons, Janal, Face the Strange, Mirrors, Whistle Speak, Iraya, Labyrinths, Lagrange Point, and Life Itself. So, again, yeah. I haven't been a fan of Star Trek Discovery, but, you know, good for them to go out while they, you know, while they are pretty much at a high point. Anyway, Star Trek's LGBTQIA plus characters will be getting the spotlight in Star Trek Celebrations number 1, a one-shot comic book from IDW arriving ahead of Pride Month 2024. The anthology comic will feature new stories starring characters like Star Trek Picard's Seven of Nine and Raffi, Strange New World's Christine Chapel, Discovery's Hugh Culber, Paul Stamets, Ardria Tall, and Gray Tall, and Star Trek Lower Decks' Beckett Mariner and Jennifer Shrayen, and the Kelvin Timeline's Haiku Rusulu. These stories will be written by Vida Aleo, Steve Orlando, Mags Vizio, and others, and will hit store shelves on May 29th. IDW's Star Trek group editor, Heather Antos, said, quote, "What is Star Trek if not the idea of celebrating the best of us, right? The best of humanity and coming together. There's a really great quote from Gene Roddenberry that's the future he wants to see. A future where all of not just tolerating one another, but celebrating one another. That is the intention behind Celebrations and where we get the title from. It's wanting to celebrate the badasses of the Star Trek universe, where that's Culber and Stamets, where that's Mariner, where that's Seven and Raffi. There's so many characters that we're going to see explored here by some incredible, incredible writers. Also coming is an upcoming Strange New Worlds novel, which will finally reveal Captain Christopher Pike's history with his number one, Una Chin Reilly. Gallery Books has revealed Star Trek Strange New Worlds by Una McCormick, the veteran Star Trek writer for whom Una was named. The novel will dig into the history between the two Starfleet officers that Strange New Worlds has alluded to, which goes back 25 years to that speech Pike gave at the Starfleet Academy that left such an impression on Cadet Chin Reilly. Strange New Worlds Asylum's title may refer to the legal status the Federation granted Una in Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 2, which allowed her to continue with her Starfleet career, even though she revealed that she was a genetically modified Ilarian. Strange New Worlds Asylum jumps the time period set 25 years apart, and here is the book's synopsis. A new Star Trek adventure based on the thrilling Paramount Plus TV series Star Trek Strange New Worlds. When Una Chin Reilly and Christopher Pike meet at Starfleet Academy after one of his lectures, they immediately become friends. A stellar student, Una is the poster girl of her class, and Pike is determined to make her a Starfleet captain with his own ship, rhetorically assembling his dream crew. As their friendship evolves, Pike also suspects Chin Reilly of being involved in Exhuana, a Choian cultural minority who are seeking asylum in the Federation space, leading to more questions than answers. 25 years later, Una and Pike are working together on the USS Enterprise to settle a Chaonian trade agreement when a pro-Exhana saboteur launches a terrorist attack. When the suspect is taken into custody for interrogation and is discovered to have a history with Una, her past associations resurface, threatening to expose a secret she's been harboring all these years. Unquote. Now, Star Trek Strange New Worlds Asylum is the second novel based on Strange New Worlds, following 2023's Star Trek Strange New Worlds The High Country by John Jackson Miller. Star Trek Strange New Worlds Asylum goes on sale on September 24th. Now, let's go on to the Star Wars news.
Roger, roger.
And we'll begin Star Trek Strange New Worlds with the Star Wars tabletop game Star Wars Shatterpoint, which is adding characters from several popular Star Trek shows in the coming months. Atomic Mass Games officially announced a trio of new squad packs, bringing in several popular characters from The Mandalorian and The Bad Batch. The Certified Guild Squad Pack comes with The Mandalorian as a primary unit, Greef Karga as a secondary unit, and IG-11 as a supporting unit. The You Have Something I Want Squad Pack as Moff Gideon as a primary unit, a Death Trooper Escort as a secondary unit, and a pair of Dark Troopers as a supporting unit. Finally, the Clone Force 99 Squad Pack adds the Bad Batch to the game with Clone Sergeant Hunter as primary unit and playable in both Clone and Galactic Civil War era squads, Wrecker and Omega as a secondary unit, Echo and Tech as supporting units, and Crosshair as a Clone Wars era secondary unit. Now let's go on to the interview with Mr. Andrew Torres, Esquire. Now it's time to get some legal perspective on the show. On February 6th, actress Gina Carano filed a lawsuit in the California U.S. District Court with one of the goofiest opening lines I've ever heard. Quote, "A short time in a galaxy not so far away, defendants make clear that only one orthodoxy in thought, speech, or action was acceptable. Now, clear that all was acceptable in their empire, and that those who dared to question or failed to fully comply would not be tolerated. And so was with Carano," and goes on from there. I won't do the whole thing. It's kind of lengthy. But in order to make sense of this, I've reached out to one of the finest legal minds and a fellow podcaster. Welcome, Andrew Torres.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. I mean, I've listened to you for years on the internet, and you know, I think I value your opinion. I really do.
Well, I appreciate that. So let's break this down. This is the worst infringement of the free speech and the First Amendment ever, or possibly this is a right wing crazy person saying crazy things. So we'll get to the bottom of it.
Tomato, tomato. Yeah. Anyway, What can you tell us about the suit to begin with?
We'll be back after a quick break.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man.
I'm
trying.
Oh,
yeah, I'm trying. I'm trying to get them on there. Look, we all artists, man. We gonna have this like
me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real. I gotta lie.
Don't play with it, take that shit seriously.
Sure. And let me give kind of the classic disclaimer first, right? I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. So none of this constitutes legal advice. Also, I advise small businesses. That's my day job. So I am familiar with labor law, but I am not a California labor attorney, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I think that's really, really important to know at the outset is that I am going to assume, and I'm probably giving Gina Carano the benefit of the doubt here, that there are no defects, no procedural defects in this lawsuit. There very well could be. So for example, right, like when you want to allege workplace discrimination, you first have to notify the California Labor and Workplace Development Agency, right? And you have to, it's called exhaust your administrative remedies, right? And basically the law says, look, before you can come into court, you have to do what you can through the administrative process, right? First with your employer and then with your state labor agency to try and get your job back. And if all of that fails, then you can bring a lawsuit. I don't know whether she's complied with that. I'm going to assume that she has, right? So let's imagine that this is a meritorious lawsuit. If that's the case, right, then what we do, as always, you read the complaint backwards, right? So you start at the very bottom. She has a perfectly respectable plaintiff's labor firm representing her. I have some questions about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is not, you know, Trump's lawyer, Alina Haba. This is not, you know, these are not crazy people, right? I mean, this is a real law firm that represents, you know, real individuals who've been aggrieved in the workplace.
Yeah, I would hope that her lawyers aren't crazy. Of course, they are paid for by Elon Musk.
And folks have talked about that. It is, I think, beyond the scope of the show, but really, really troublesome that you have the richest man in the country essentially soliciting and trying to sue media outlets into oblivion. Look, it's not going to work with Disney, right? But, Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against Gawker brought down Gawker. Right.
Yeah.
I have long said that the major structural defect in our civil judicial system is rich corporations, rich people suing each other and clogging up the and virtually every ill that we have today in the legal system, I think, can be traced back to that. So, yeah, the fact that Musk is bankrolling, solicited, promoting this lawsuit, that should be problematic kind of no matter what, right? And go ahead. I'm sorry.
And so this was 3 years after it happened. So do you think Elon Musk's doing was kind of the catalyst for this?
It very clear. I mean, it seems to be, right? I suppose it could be coincidental. I should have, you're really perceptive to bring out that time lapse, because there could be statute of limitations issues here as well. And again, I kind of file that all under, there are lots of reasons why this might not get out the door, but assume that it gets out the door.
Okay.
Carano is alleging three counts in her complaint, right? So you kind of move back from the signature to counts 1, 2, and 3. Counts 1 and 2, I'm going to get to in a minute. Those are allegations of violations of Section 1101 of the California Labor Code. That is wrongful discharge, that she was fired for a political reason, and that they refused to hire her back for a political reason. Yeah. And we'll get to kind of the gravamen of those claims. Count three is ridiculous. I mean, count three alleges sex discrimination. And essentially the argument is Disney was perfectly happy to let its male stars engage in political activity, but they didn't let her engage in political activity. You know, it's sort of almost not worth debunking. I mean, you know, she's pointed to, you know, Mark Hamill, you know, sort of well-known tweets out on yeah. various progressive causes, that sort of thing. And all of it kind of falls under the, you know, you fired me because you're woke and I'm not rubric, right?
Right.
And this, I think, hits at the major misconception that Elon Musk is putting it. Again, Musk has said this. Carano has said that. Her side has said this. And really, really good lawyers have kind of run with it because you need to parse it very, very, very carefully. But it's wrong. And that claim is that political affiliation is a protected class in California.
Yes.
That's not true. It is flatly false. I'm going to talk about the way in which political activity is protected, but it is a much narrower subset. And this matters not just to a lawyer. You know, I mean, I love getting in the weeds on all of this stuff, but it really, really matters, because when something is a protected class, that is, the federal government sort of sets the baseline, right, of, you know, race, sex and sexual orientation and gender identity and religion. And then states can build on top of that and add additional characteristics that it thinks that it is prima facie wrong for the state to discriminate against you on the basis of these characteristics. And usually they're what we call in the law immutable characteristics, right? So yeah, the age discrimination, I can't do anything about how old I am. Yeah. You know, your ancestry, your race, those, you know, can't do anything about that. And so California has a very robust civil rights law. It's called the UNRRA Act, after Jesse UNRRA. And it is section 51 of the California Code. And it has 17 protected classes. So age, ancestry, gender expression, gender identity, marital status, medical condition, national origin, race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, veteran military status, and a couple of others, right? And so that that expands federal law. And it says, If you undertake any activity on the basis of a protected class, then that is per se prohibited under the law. Here's what it says, right? It says all persons within the state are free and equal, no matter what their, and then lists off those 17 characteristics, and are entitled to the full and equal accommodations, advantages, facilities, privileges, or services in all business establishments of every kind whatsoever. Okay. So in other words, if you're a member of a protected class, then you must be treated equally, regardless of that specific identity, everywhere throughout the state in all private business transactions, right? So, you know, a restaurant can't say, get out of here with your MAGA hat on, right? Yeah. And you could imagine, you know, kind of the fullest extent of that. The case I use to illustrate this that is somewhat infamous in California, 1985 California Supreme Court case called Quire, K-O-I-R-E, versus Metro Car Wash. And it's this guy who in 1979 was a troll. And what he would do is he would go around to bars and nightclubs. And for some reason, car washes in California, it was the 70s, man, you know, it is a different time, right? That had ladies' nights, right? And so apparently ladies' night or ladies' day at the car wash was a big thing. And so I am not kidding. There was a nightclub that had a $2 cover charge, and they waived it for women on a particular night. And he said, well, when are the men going to get waived? And the nightclub was like, this is a nightclub, man. Like, we don't need to try hard to bring in men. Right. And he sued. And the trial court was like, oh, come on, get out of here with this. And the appellate court was like, no, really, get out of here with this. And the California Supreme Court reversed. And they said, notwithstanding the fact that we don't think there's a real injury here, and notwithstanding the fact that you're obviously a troll, and notwithstanding the fact that the statute wasn't designed to protect men, right? The UNRRA Act says gender is a protected class. And so we think that means you can't treat anybody differently at the minimal level of knocking $2 off the cover charge. So ladies' nights have been illegal in California for almost 40 years, right? That's the background that Gina Carano and her lawyers and her backers would have you believe applies to political class in California. It does not. It's not, not even read the statute, just not in there. And so you don't get that broad protection, right? What you get is a much narrower protection. And that's the basis for the first two counts in the lawsuit. It is Section 1101 of the California Labor Code. And I'm going to read it in its entirety. It's pretty short. It says, no employer shall make, adopt, or enforce any rule, regulation, or policy, A, forbidding or preventing employees from engaging or participating in politics or from becoming candidates for public office. Okay, that clearly is not even alleged here. Or B, controlling or directing or tending to control or direct the political activities or affiliations of employees. And you might think kind of on its face, well, okay, that's where Gina Carano is trying to cram this, you know, round peg into the square hole of that 1101B, right? Because, I mean, let's talk about the fact, right? Like, as far as I can tell, Gina Carano tweeted out, quote, most people today don't realize that to get to the point where Nazi soldiers could easily round up thousands of Jews, the government first made their own neighbors hate them simply for being Jews. How is that any different from hating someone for their political views? Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of an apples and oranges type of deal.
Yeah, that's right, right? And look, you can put that together with after she was dropped by Disney, right? Mm-hmm. Gina Carano went on to, have a pretty major role in the propaganda pick my son Hunter, right? Which is, just nonsense, right? Like she clearly has, you know, wandered into MAGA land and been embraced with open arms. But again, right. There is no question, right? I mean, you want to try and steel bot the other side, right? Like, there is no question that there is a political cast to the things that she said, right? She's,
right.
You know, she was anti-masking, and I don't know if she was anti-vax. She's expressed that, you know, maybe there was fraud in the 2020 election. I mean, you know, right. She's associated with these dingbat MAGA positions. Right. And the question is, suppose Disney fired her because they said, look, we're a woke company and we don't want our employees going around comparing being a supporter of Donald Trump to being rounded up by the Nazis and, saying that, the 2020 election was stolen and stuff like that. Now, mind you, I think Disney has much stronger grounds to say, like, no, look, like, what we were doing was we terminated our relationship with somebody who was grotesquely insensitive to a historically discriminated against group of people. But for purposes of a motion to dismiss, you have to treat the plaintiff's allegations in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, right? Go ahead.
Now, Now, I can attest, being I work for a corporation myself, mm-hmm. begins with W, ends in art. You can fill in the between there.
Right.
And they have a social media policy that I have to follow. Basically, I can't release trade secrets. I can't really disparage the company too much. You know, there's a whole, and there's also a morality policy as well that says, you know, what I, you know, I can't go out and rob a bank and expect right. to come into work, things like that.
Right.
So I assume Disney has kind of the same type of policies.
I am sure that their contract with Gina Carano has some of those provisions. And again, I would sort of put those, all of those questions into that kind of first bucket that we talked about, that, right? Like there may be lots of reasons that this, you know, doesn't get out the door. But if it does, I'm kind of trying to give her factually the maximum benefit of the doubt, because sure. to be fair, that's what the legal system will and should do. Right. Like if you factually disagree over something, right, if Gina Carano says, look, Disney fired me because I'm a conservative, and Disney says, we didn't fire you because you're a conservative. We fired you because you're a jerk. Right. Well, then and that's it. Right. Then you would want that to be able potentially to go to a jury, or at least to go to discovery, to say like, hey, look, are there communications between Bob Iger and, you know, whatever, that says, look, like, you know, we got too many of these mega idiots working for us. Let's, you know, let's get rid of Carano. If that's Disney's sole defense is, no, we didn't fire you because of your political beliefs. We fired you for these other reasons. Then you have to adjudicate whether that's true or not. I'm saying, let's assume that is the case. Let's assume that okay. they won't. Let's assume Disney comes out and says, yeah, we fired you because you said, not because you're a conservative, but because the things that you ascribe to a conservative ideology are patently offensive and inconsistent with how Disney wants to do business. And the question is that good enough? Right. And so that's why I kind of went through that lengthy discussion on not being a protected class, because look, if political affiliation were protected class in California, that would not be good enough. Right. You couldn't say, you would say, look, you're treating Democrats and Republicans unequally. Right. Mm-hmm. And just because Republicans are more likely to say stupid shit that you disagree with. But that's still prohibited, right? Like that's the car wash example. I don't care what your reasons are, right? Like there are very good economic reasons for a nightclub to want to waive the cover charge for women coming in and not for men coming in, but you can't do it because it's a protected class.
Yeah.
Because political affiliation is not a protected class, you then have to ask, what is political activity and what does it mean to try and control it? And so, again, if I'm steelbotting the Gina Carano side, she would say, look, your employer's contract with you that says don't embarrass them, don't engage in activity that brings them into disrepute, you know, be pleasant, right? That's fine, because that's not that doesn't treat political affiliation differently. But Disney has shown over and over again that when its stars support progressive causes, that it's behind them, and when its stars oppose progressive causes, that they fire them. And so then the question is, okay, assume that's right. Does that rise to the level of trying to control your employees' political activity? And I've read, I can't say every 1101 case in California, there are an awful lot, but at the appellate, I've read a lot of these cases because I've gone looking for something comparable, and I can't find one, right? What I find are a lot of cases that say, hey, you didn't show up for work because you went to an Obama rally, and therefore we're firing you. Mm-hmm. And again, right? That's an area where, even if it's not on the basis of ideology, right? Like it would be equally bad if they said, no, you can't go to MAGA rallies in your, you know, in your free time, or you can't take off from work to go to MAGA rallies. That would be an employer trying to dictate the political activity of its employees. Obviously, there's zero evidence that they ever tried to do that with Gina Carano. Right. Yeah. They never said, hey, you can't be on Twitter. They never said you can't support Donald Trump. They never said you can't go to a Trump rally. They never said you can't vote for Trump. You can't. Right. Like all of the things that classically constitute political activity, voting, running for office, attending rallies, organizing. There was nothing. Right. Mm-hmm. So then the question is saying, you hate me for my politics, how is that any different than the Nazis rounding up the Jews, right? Is that, because it certainly has a political overtone to it. Mm-hmm. It is that sufficient to constitute interference with political activity? And again, as far as I can tell from the case law, A, no, it isn't. But B, even if it were, the other important difference between a protected class and an 1101 claim is the burden shifts, right? If you're in a protected class, your burden is to demonstrate that you're a member of that class and that your employer made a decision that has a disparate impact. And there are other forms, I'm sort of speaking broadly, right? But that your employer made a decision that affected you differently because of your on the basis of that membership in the class. And then the burden shifts to the employer to offer a justification not based on your membership in the class. Mm-hmm. And then the burden, if they do, and they'll always say like, well, you know, it was performance or whatever. And then the burden shifts back to the individual to say that justification was pretextual. And when you were talking about a protected class, distinctions on the basis of that class are strongly disfavored, right? So, you know, we only hire women to do these kinds of jobs, right? Like, it's very, very difficult for that sort of policy to survive, right? Yeah. In an 1101 claim, it is the employee's burden to show that the employer had the intent to discriminate on the basis of political affiliation or activity, right? And so if the employer has, and this is the language from every case, a legitimate non-political justification, the case goes away. That's the end of the 1101 inquiry. They must have an expressly political motive, right? If they have a business motive, that's not political retaliation. And so it strikes me as kind of beyond obvious that Disney is going to say, look, these facts, as alleged, do not add up to an allegation that we acted with political motive. Here are all the conservative star, you know, we've had James Woods come through here. We've had, right, like, you know, John Voight, right? And we didn't do anything against them. That they're well known. They can be conservative. They can be outspoken. They can have whatever views they want, so long as their views do not bring Disney into disrepute by suggesting something as idiotic as being a supporter of Donald Trump is like being rounded up at the Holocaust in 1939 Germany, right? Like,
exactly.
And I have a hard time seeing, you know, that this case is going anywhere.
Yeah, and you know, it has been kind of noticeable that Disney has yet to respond to this. Is that anything, you know, we should be giving credence to here?
No, and in fact, I mean, this lawsuit was only filed on February 6th, right? So even against an in-state defendant, you have 30 days before you're required to answer the complaint. Typically, lawyers will ask for and get additional time in order to file like a dispositive motion, like a motion to dismiss that I think is coming. So it should not be surprised. I mean, I know, you know, it feels like this has been out in the public consciousness forever. It's been 20 days in court time, which is nothing, right? And right. So, you know, no, you shouldn't read anything into the fact that there has been no development. And in fact, on the docket, right, Disney has, you know, noticed the appearance of, you know, two dozen lawyers because it's a multi-billion dollar multinational corporation. And, you know, and it pains me a little bit to be, you know, shilling for, you know, huge corporation here. So that's the bottom line, right? It has been an eye blink in judicial terms. What's coming next is going to be a motion to dismiss. I just gave the big case against this lawsuit. I do not want to say, you know, I would not push my chips all in. Like, it's not 100% that the court is going to grant the motion to dismiss for a couple of reasons, right? Like, number one, courts tend, although this is federal court, state courts are even more favorable in terms of wanting to give a party their day in court, right? Like, courts are, you know, if you think you've been aggrieved, part of the judicial process is, so long as, you know, you're not completely outside the box, okay, state how you were aggrieved and let's let the legal process play out. And so there's a little bit of that there. And there is a little bit of the of a subjective question, right? In federal court, there are a line of cases that are sometimes referred to as Twickball, right? It is Twombly and Iqbal, and it basically, that sets the minimum bar as to what constitutes, and the language is, a plausible claim for relief, right? So, in other words, example I use all the time, right? Like, if you sue me for trespass, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, Andrew came to my house in the middle of the night, scaled my fence, and was on my property. And I say, I have never been to the state of Kansas. Oh, I've been once, but like, I've never been to Kansas. I've never been anywhere near your house, right? You've still stated a plausible claim of relief. Right. We have a factual dispute. But if, in fact, I scaled your fence and ran around in your yard and all of that, that would be trespass. And so if my only defense is I've never been to Kansas, then you survive Twickball. Right. You get to bring your case. I move to dismiss. And the court says, well, let's figure out if Torres has been to Kansas or not. And then, you know, maybe we can move quickly. Maybe we can't. And discovery is long and expensive, particularly on individual litigants. But that's how the court will rule that. And so, you know, Disney is saying this, but you really fired me because, you know, I'm conservative. Could you see a judge cobbling that together and saying, taking all facts as alleged by Gina as true and all inferences resolved in her favor, we think that there's a plausible claim that Disney was trying to direct her political activities. I can see that. I don't think it's the likely opinion, I think, for the reasons that I stated. But, you know, 75-25, it might go forward. And again, you know, don't cry for them, Argentina, right? Like, Gina Carano has plenty of money. Disney has all the money, right? Like, that, you know, they're doing fine. But that would be the implication. So what we're going to see next in the next couple of weeks is a motion to dismiss and then briefing on that.
Now, when we go to page 57 of the complaint, her prayer for relief, the thing that strikes me about that is she wants the rollback.
Well, that is actually what you get in employment law cases, by and large, right? Like, employment law cases, the remedies are usually restricted to reinstatement with back pay. Sometimes there are additional damages that come into play, but typically no. And if you think about it, that's because these laws were not written with actors in mind. They were written with, you know, I'm the floor manager, right? And you know, I got fired. I shouldn't have been fired. And I want my job back as the floor manager. You are right, though, that there is often a tension in these labor law cases of, well, you know, you've just spent, you know, 2 years alleging that this, you know, hellhole is the worst place on earth to work. Why do you want to go back there?
Right? Exactly.
And that happens. But, you know, but yeah, so I'm not surprised by that. But it does kind of illustrate, if this case ever does go forward on the merits, that, again, Disney has these, you know, additional arguments that a court is likely to find persuasive in an 1101 context that wouldn't work in a protected class context.
And again, they could just kill, you know, bring her back and just kill her off in the first episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And then she would have to go through the burden of saying, no, you're just doing that to retaliate against me. Mm-hmm. And they would say, no. Like, you know, here's a script from 2017 that said we always intended for this character to get, you know, murdered by Baby Yoda or whatever. Which would, admittedly, I would tune in to watch Gina Carano get murdered by Baby Yoda.
And finally, I did notice that nowhere in the filing did it make an outright freedom of speech argument. Now, yeah. this is kind of a smart thing to do.
Yes, because, again, remember that the First Amendment applies to the activities of government, right? Mm-hmm. Not to private individuals. That there is a way to allege that a private party has violated your constitutional rights, right? So, in other words, if your employer says, you know, no, you know, you can't vote, you know, if you want to work for Chick-fil-A, like, you better not vote in this upcoming election, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, right? Like that obviously is impermissible. The threshold to prove that they tried to control her speech, I think, you know, she sort of wisely, you know, even as much as the rest of this is a stretch, you know, knew that this was not going to pass muster of, you know, you interfered with my First Amendment rights of expression. You retaliated against me for speaking, as opposed to, you know, you acted as an employer that, you know, has a very public facing business that didn't want to be affiliated with that. The example that I put out on Blue Sky the other day that I think kind of reasonably separates it out is, right, Disneyland is also in California, right? Yeah. And if Disneyland had a policy that said cast members who wanted to play Ariel, the Little Mermaid, had to be white, that policy would not last very long.
No.
Right. No, right. Yeah. And you would say, and it wouldn't matter. Disney could say, well, we think Ariel kind of has a particular image, and the court would come back with the choir language. They would be like, we don't really care. You know, you can't say only white cast members get to play Ariel. Now, I want you to imagine a cast member is selected to play Ariel and decides to put a big red MAGA hat on, or a vote Biden, you know, a bumper, a button. Right? You would say, no, Ariel lives under the sea with a crab. She doesn't have an opinion on the 2024 presidential election. And I think, I mean, it is clear Disney has those regulations that prevent individual political expression when you are a cast member at Disneyland. And I think that's a good illustration here, right? Carano falls on the, like, you can't play Ariel while you're wearing a MAGA hat. Sorry, right? Like, that's just the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, I think we've gone over this plenty. Yeah, we've kind of exhausted pretty much all the arguments up to this point. So I would like to, you know, in the future, when we get more of this, maybe invite you back to talk more about this.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. I guess if I were going to leave you with sort of one anecdote that to me kind of wraps up intuitively, you know, how you ought to feel and ought to be wagering. I don't know if you recall the case of the Google engineer James Damore, right, who sent out an unsolicited memo to everybody at Google that said Google is way too woke and, you know, is too committed to DEI, and they fired him, and he sued, withdrew that lawsuit. It went kind of nowhere. As a result of that, in 2021, California State Senator Melissa Menendez, California State Senator Melissa Melendez, Republican, proposed Senate Bill 238, which she called the Diversity of Thought Act. It would have amended the UNRRA Act and included political affiliation as a protected class. She wanted to deal with what she called, quote, the climate of intolerance and cancel culture. It was introduced on January 21, 2021, mm-hmm. referred to the Judiciary Committee, where it failed 9-2. So the way to think about that is, if it were already illegal to, you know, be too woke in California, you probably wouldn't have needed this piece of legislation. And the fact that that piece of legislation went down in flames gives you some idea about, you know, what it's like to be an employer in California.
All right, Andrew. Now, where can people find you?
Best place to find me right now is on Blue Sky, for reasons that I think a lot of people know, like Twitter is just toxic and horrible, right? And I don't want to be supporting. I was very persuaded by my buddy Liz Dye, who also, I mean, you know, gave up a huge platform on Twitter to say, no, even if we're a tiny cog in the machine that is enabling the platforming of Nazis, I don't want to be a part of that anymore. And I agree with that. So I'm on Blue Sky, Andrew Torres, AndrewTorrez, and you know, doing my thing, making observations about the law, and would love to see you there.
All right, now back to me in this very same chair. And we're back from the interview. I'd like to again thank Andrew Torres, attorney at law, for being our guest today to talk about the Gina Carano Disney lawsuit. You know, yeah. And hopefully we'll hear from him again in the not too distant future. Anyway, let's get on and finish up with some geek news. Starting off, Harry Potter is set to return to the small screen in 2026. The first installment of the Harry Potter TV series will be targeted to hit Max in 2026. Warner Bros. Discovery CEO David Zaslav said on the company's fourth quarter earnings call that the series is expected to span 7 seasons, which will adapt each book in the fantasy book series. Now, on the call, Zaslav said he was in London a few weeks ago with HBO and Max content boss Casey Bloys and Channing Dungey, chairperson of Warner Bros. Television, to meet with the author J.K. Rowling about the show. So, what do you think about them doing the novels as basically long form? So they're adapting one novel at a time. You know, so instead of, you know, a two-hour compression, you get the entire novel over a season, like they did with the Series of Unfortunate Events novels over at Netflix. You know, I think that might be a good idea. Turning to other news, Academy Award winner Peter Ramsey and former Overbook head Caleb Pinkett are set to produce a live-action feature adaptation of The Storm Clan, a comic book created by Dallas Jackson and Joe Casey, which marks the first title from Jackson's new company, DJ Classics Comics. Jackson and Casey will be penning the script with former Lionsgate exec George Alfaro to serve as an executive producer. A sci-fi fantasy action story, the Storm Clan watches as an ex-military weapons engineer trains his five adopted children to be undercover high-tech martial arts thieves wearing invincible bionic body armor. Previously orphaned, the teenagers gifted with bionic tech see it provide them with the opportunity to protect themselves from the threats of the streets, also empowering them to take advantage of life instead of being taken advantage of, and most importantly, giving them comfort and a sense of belonging with a family. Jackson said in a statement to Deadline.com, quote, "It's been a dream come true to bring my first comic IP, The Storm Clan, to life with Marvel DC legend Joe Casey. Together, we've created a gritty, high-tech world that not only combines teen issues with a unique family dynamic, but an IP that organically translates to a film franchise that will appeal to audiences worldwide." Now, on some labor news, some of the only Disneyland resort workers who are not unionized announced today that they're organizing with the Actors Equity Association. Now, ironically, they are among the most public-facing of the resort's employees. Calling themselves Magic United, cast members who work in the Disneyland Resort's characters and parades departments have begun circulating union authorization cards to 1,700 members and will seek voluntary recognition from Disney Resort Entertainment when the majority of the workers have signed. Characters and parades employees are those that roam the park dressed as, you know, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Elsa from Frozen. They bring characters to life in shows, parades, meet and greets, and character dining experiences. Hosts, trainers, leads, and other roles that support performance are also included in the effort. And it's worth noting that cast members who do the same work at Walt Disney World have been unionized for decades. Among the concerns noted in a statement from the union are safe and sanitary workplace conditions, a fair wage, and more transparency in scheduling and rehiring decisions. Now, a Disneyland official said in a statement to Deadline, "We believe that our cast members deserve to have all the rights, facts, and the right to a confidential vote that recognizes their individual choices." Unquote. In other words, they've been pressing down their thumb to try to get these people not to sign. The Services Trade Council Union at Walt Disney represents more than 45,000 other Disney employees, reached a contract agreement in March of 2023. The deal grants them that by October 2026, all current employees would expect a minimum wage of $20.50 an hour. Individuals hired after December 3rd, 2023 would receive $20 per hour by that time. Now, the Parks and Experiences Unit is the economic driver pretty much since COVID ended. The leaders of Magic United released a statement, quote, "We chose Actors Equity Association as our union because we've seen how well they work with Disney in Florida on Broadway and on tour. Our Walt Disney World colleagues exemplify how you can be pro-Disney and pro-union at the same time. Furthermore, the vast majority of our park colleagues here in Anaheim already have union representation. It's a win-win. When we can speak with a collective voice, we can have a clearer, more productive conversation with our employer. Ultimately, this will result in better experiences for all, cast members, managers, and more importantly, our guests." Now, let me cover some awards news really quick. Starting with the BAFTA Awards, which is a precursor to the Oscars usually, and the Oscars, which will be happening on March 10th. The ceremony had a two-hour delay in the UK and US. Best film went to Oppenheimer. Emma Stone won for leading actress, and Cillian Murphy won for leading actor for Oppenheimer. Now, Oppenheimer won several awards. They won director and original score, and also best supporting actress or actor for Robert Downey Jr. And Poor Things won special visual effects for Simon Hughes. I'll have kind of a list of those in the show notes. But let's also cover the Annie Awards. These are for animation. Best Feature went to Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Best Direction went to the team at Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Best Direction TV went to Paul Young for Star Wars Visions. Awards also went to The Boy and the Heron, Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, Blue Eye Samurai, Hilda, and a lot of other shows as well. And we'll have all those for you in the show notes. Now we close out the show with a little sad news, of course. The legendary Paul Neary, known for iconic work at both Marvel and DC, passed away at the age of 74. Neary's friend and colleague, Alan Davis, shared the news in a statement that he passed away on February 10th after a long battle with illness, and in that same post shared a touching tribute to Neary's incredible work in the industry. Neary was one of the rare talents who could write, ink, color, letter, and edit. And throughout his career, he would create all-time runs on books like Excalibur, Batman and the Outsiders, The Authority, Ultimates, and JLA. In addition to serving as Marvel UK editor-in-chief at two different times. Now, Davis wrote, quote, "Extremely sad news about Paul Neary, a mentor, colleague, and friend. Paul Neary, born in Bournemouth, England, 18 December 1949, passed away on 10 February 2024 after a long illness. In a career of more than 50 years, Paul created international respect and recognition in numerous roles within the comic book industry. Paul could write, pencil, ink, color, letter, and edit, skills he learned from studying the medium with an academic zeal. Comics were an enthusiastic hobby for Paul after he moved to Leeds University to study for a degree in metallurgy, but in his first summer break, Paul traveled to New York, bluffed his way to Jim Warren's office, and secured his first professional work on Eerie Magazine, most notably the Hunter series. When Warren Publishing was liquidated, Paul found work in the UK with Hammer comic movie adaptations, the Doctor Who magazine, and ghosting Sid Jordan on the Lance McLean newspaper strip. The short, diverse projects suited Paul's eclectic and experimental nature, and it wasn't enough for full-time employment. Paul eventually accepted an art editorial role at Marvel UK, where he met his partner, now wife of over 40 years, Bernie Jane. On becoming the editor-in-chief, Paul wanted to do more than repackage reprinting of U.S. comics and set out to originate his homegrown strip, most notably reinventing Captain Britain. Paul also had a passion for sci-fi-based comics like Mystery in Space and the more eclectic art published in European magazines and albums, and was evident by his own creations, Madman, Tales from the Rim, and Wild Weed. Paul transitioned from penciling to inking on Batman the Outsiders, Detective, and Excalibur, then returned to the UK as art director for Marvel, where he helmed the creation and evolution of such titles as Dark Angel, Motormouth, Dark Guard, Death's Head, Knights of Pendragon, and The Clandestine. While the list of titles is impressive, Paul's greatest accomplishment was the environment he established to help new creators learn and develop skills that would propel them into success in the U.S. comic market after Marvel UK fell victim to industry decline. Paul resumed inking and finished on such titles as The Authority, Ultimates, and JLA, where his outstanding work was acknowledged and awarded. Sadly, illness struck. Those lucky to have known Paul will remember him as an intensely private man who had no interest in fame or public acclaim. Paul loved the creative process and fostering the creativity in others. Always professional, enthusiastic, and polite, but just below the surface, Paul's anarchic sense of humor was poised to mock the mighty and expose the injustices of life. The greatest injustice being he went too soon. Condolences, thoughts, and prayers to Bernie, unquote. Paul Neary was 74 years old. And finally tonight, Kenneth Mitchell, who played several characters in Star Trek Discovery and also was known for his roles in Jericho and Captain Marvel, has died from complications of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, his family revealed this past Saturday. He was 49 years old. Quote, "With heavy hearts, we announce the passing of Kenneth Alexander Mitchell, beloved father, husband, brother, uncle, son, and dear friend," his family shared on Twitter. Quote, "For 5.5 years, Ken faced a series of awful challenges from ALS, and in truest Ken fashion, he managed to rise above each one with grace and commitment to living a full and joyous life in every moment. He lived by the principles that each day is a gift and will never walk alone." Now, Mitchell announced publicly that he'd been diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, in 2020 in an interview with People magazine. Quote, The moment they told us that was ALS, it was like I was in my own movie. That's what it felt like I was watching that scene where someone is being told they have a terminal illness. It was just complete disbelief, a shock. Now, Mitchell played three Klingon characters in Star Trek Discovery's first two seasons. He portrayed Cole in Season 1, Cole Shaw, and Tenevik in Season 2. In Season 3, as the disease progressed, he played Aurelio, a character who used a hover chair, created to incorporate his need for a wheelchair into the series. He also voiced three characters in the first season of Star Trek Lower Decks, Season 1, as a Black Ops operative and a Romulan guard. StarTrek.com paid tribute to Mitchell, quote, "Being a part of Star Trek keeps me inspired and gives me purpose," Mitchell told Sci-Fi Wire in 2020. "Hopefully, they will keep going," unquote. Mitchell was also known for his role as Eric Green in CBS's Jericho. On the film side, he portrayed Joseph Danvers in 2019's Captain Marvel, the father of Carol Danvers, who appeared in a flashback with the young Carol, and early in his career as Ralph Cox in the biopic Miracle in 2004. He also had additional television credits, including the Astronaut Wives Club, Switched at Birth, and guest spots in Code Black, CSI Cyber, and NCIS, among others. Mitchell is survived by his wife Susan, their children Lilla and Kellum, his parents and in-laws, and several nieces and nephews. The family asks that any gifts be directed toward ALS research or toward his children. A GoFundMe campaign has been set up for his kids. Again, Kenneth Mitchell was 49 years old. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the show. Well, please be sure to check us out on social media. We're at Twitter at Multiverse Tom. We're also on Facebook and Instagram as well as Blue Sky. And you can also find me on Threads at Multiverse Tonight. Now, if you found value in the show, please head on over to multiversetonight.com. Check out the show notes, visit RT Public Store, and so much more. And if you're brand new to the show, welcome. Be a subscriber. Share us with friends, family, and so on. And leave some feedback. Let us know how we're doing. Special thanks to Shane Ivers for the intro music and Lobo Loco for the outro theme music. Thanks for watching this edition of Multiverse Tonight. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more sci-fi and comic book news. Now, please exit the universe in an orderly fashion. Good night. Multiverse Tonight is a production of Half-Baked Genre Productions, copyright 2024, all rights reserved. This podcast is part of the Pop Goes the Culture podcast network. Find out more about our other podcasts at popgoestheculture.com.